Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode featuring Dr. Rebecca Sipes. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Rebecca Sipes, and I'm a professor of music and associate dean for academic affairs at Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University.
Fabulous. Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sounds or music and why this was such a formative experience for you?
Sure. I went to a Solomon Schechter school when I was young, from kindergarten through eighth grade. And so music, Jewish music, was very much part of my upbringing and my education in that environment. I have memories going all the way back to kindergarten of my wonderful kindergarten teacher, Sandra, playing her guitar and singing Jewish songs with us, holiday songs. We used to have nap time with records playing, so of course I could never fall asleep. But now I sing those songs with my kids, and we have a good laugh about how these are songs from when I was really little. So I was really fortunate to have music and Jewish music be a really significant part of my life from when I was very little and in that day school environment.
I am Antiochus, and this is what I say. You must build your statues, and that is how you'll pray.
What do we say? We say nay. You're not gonna be the boss of me.
At the same time, when I was growing up, I was part of youth choirs that really had very little to do with Jewish music. And so I was sort of trying to reconcile those competing interests. But I was very much interested in singing. I had piano lessons from when I was really little, and I would play Hanukkah songs, and my teachers would try to incorporate Jewish sounds into what I was doing to the greatest extent that they could. But I always wanted a very broad musical education and didn't necessarily see a contradiction between Jewish music and non-Jewish music, and really enjoyed everything.
What was your journey like from being enmeshed in the world of both Jewish and secular music as a young person through to graduate or undergraduate programs? How did you decide to take your interest in music production and professionalize it?
Sure. So, I mean, I knew what I wanted to focus on in music from high school. I had a high school music teacher who was an early music fanatic, and he brought me along with him, Don Irving. Shout out to Don. He introduced me to all sorts of early music. He owned a harpsichord, and he would let me noodle around on the harpsichord. So I would like feed his cats in the summer and in exchange get to practice on his harpsichord. We did recorder consort music. We did madrigal choirs. We did musical theater and regular choirs. And he was just very generous with his time and his knowledge in sharing kind of mainstream music as well as early music. And so I knew when I was applying to colleges that I wanted to focus on early music and especially historical keyboard instruments. I didn't have a particular interest in pursuing Jewish music or music in Jewish life and history until much later. I sort of assumed that professional music studies meant studying, you know, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven. It meant studying the classical tradition, the canon. And I did a paper on Salmone Rossi when I was a sophomore in college, but it didn't really occur to me that that could ever become a special point of focus for me in my research. And throughout graduate school, that remained the same. I went to graduate school to study with Ellen Rosand. She's been an incredible mentor and advocate for me over the years and totally understands where I'm coming from as a Jewish person. But, you know, it was never on our agenda to pursue Jewish music studies at all. And then it was really years after I finished graduate school and came to Rutgers, and I met a colleague in the Department of Jewish Studies, Nancy Sinkoff. And Nancy is just an incredibly energetic person who has all sorts of great ideas that she is able to turn into reality. So we started talking about our shared interests and started exploring the possibility of organizing a symposium around the figure of Sara Levi, who was a Jewish woman who lived in Berlin in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and was a kind of amateur aficionado, but a really an adept, very skilled keyboard player and a collector of music. And she was instrumental in the perpetuation of the Bach legacy in the generation following the death of Johann Sebastian Bach. And so that sort of opened a world of Jewish music studies for me, especially as it intersects with my interests in early music, that then led me in some really different directions in my life. I should just add, kind of as an aside, it was an aside at the time also, but when I was in graduate school, I did some studying. It felt kind of peripheral to my work as a musicologist, but I took a year off from music studies and studied at the Drescher Institute for Jewish Education in Manhattan. And I also did an MA in Bible at the Bernard Rebel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University. So I was doing those things. It felt like it was in a kind of ancillary way to my scholarship, but for my personal edification and expansion of my knowledge. And so to be able to bring together Jewish studies and musicology, as I have been able to do in the last 10, 12 years, has been really rewarding. And, you know, I'm very grateful to Nancy for kind of opening that prospect to me.
What advice would you offer to prospective students or new scholars who are planning to enter either the field of early music studies or Jewish music studies?
I think that the advice that I would offer would be the same as the advice that I would offer to any prospective graduate student. And that is to think about scholarship, to think about research as about asking questions. And if we can approach research as a process of asking questions, it's a generous way of being a scholar. I think often, you know, scholars, especially in the humanities, where we're supposed to be doing very solitary research and staking out our original claims, we kind of get locked into almost a defensive mode in our work. Like, oh, this is my territory. I don't want anybody else to encroach on my territory. But if we can think about research as about just opening ideas and asking questions, it's just a more generous stance in general. And I think that we're more open to receiving new ideas and open to collaboration. And collaboration, for me, has become one of the main modes of my work. So recognizing that I don't know everything, and maybe other people also don't know everything, but if we get together and talk about ideas and ask questions together, we're more likely to learn things. So that would be a kind of word of advice.
Yeah, that's great. Great feedback. So you've mentioned a couple already, but who have some of your other mentors or advocates been throughout your scholarly journey?
I think I have to come back to Ellen, and I'll say a little bit more about her. So Ellen Rosand was my PhD advisor at Yale, and I think she cut through incredible obstacles for me when I was in graduate school without even my being aware that those obstacles existed. So just as an example, when I got to Yale, there was a requirement that graduate students in the music program take 3 seminars and a 4th something else. And it could be the 4th something else could be something in, a class in another department or a language class. And I wanted to take harpsichord lessons at the Yale School of Music. And I was accepted into the studio of the harpsichord professor there. And I think that there was some resistance on the part of other faculty members who still saw a very rigid distinction between the academic study of music and the practical applied study of music. And Ellen fought for me because she saw that I had the potential to join those fields. And indeed, that has become a really significant part of my research agenda, using performance to enhance research and vice versa, right? So Ellen really went to bat for me in that instance. And then another big thing was that I had my first child a couple of months before I took my comprehensive exams at Yale. And Ellen made everybody else know that it would be okay. So if other people thought that, oh, this shows, Rebecca doesn't have a commitment to the field or a commitment to the program, I'll admit it was a little bit crazy. But Ellen just pushed through and convinced everybody else that they should just let me do what I needed to do. And it turned out fine.
Yeah, we all need mentors who will go to bat like that for us.
Yeah. So now what I try to do is for my students or for other people whom I'm trying to support, I will often think, what would Ellen do? And then that actually helps me steel myself, I guess, or it helps me grow the confidence to be assertive on behalf of other people and advocate for their needs. Because now I'm a tenured full professor and I have that stability and that security in my job. And so it's my turn to pay it forward.
Incredible. Can you tell me about one of your most recently completed research projects, whether it relates to Jewish music or not, and why you selected it? What excites you most about it?
Sure. So I'll talk a little about the book that I co-edited together with Lynette Bowring and Liza Malamut called Music and Jewish Culture in Early Modern Italy. And that book was published by Indiana University Press in 2022. It was such a wonderful project, not least because it opened all these new avenues of collaboration that I didn't have access to before. And I learned so much from the process of putting that book together. So Liza is a performer and a scholar. She's now the director of the Newbery Consort. So she's really living the whole life of the scholar performer. And I had the privilege of being her outside reader for her dissertation at Boston University several years ago. And Lynette was my PhD advisee at Rutgers. So this started out as a real labor of love, just because I had developed such positive relationships and good working relationships with both of them. And they got to know each other in the process. And I think that the three of us made a really good team. So we started by putting out a call for papers, really not knowing what would come in. And what did come in was just a collection of fantastic proposals, really exciting proposals that I think opened up a lot of new horizons in the study of music and Jewish culture in early modern Italy. And it got us thinking about issues of acculturation and the articulation of community, issues of cross-cultural exchange, ideas of figures like the marginal mediator, those individuals who from the margins of society are able to mediate between cultures, and music as a means of articulating identity and community, but also as a means of cross-cultural exchange. So the whole project, the edited books take years to put together, and it's a very long haul, but we had such a great team. And I think that the chapters in the book, they're just splendid. They're really, really wonderful pieces of scholarship that involve really strong original research, original interpretations. So yeah, it's wonderful to look back on where we started and really not knowing how the project would develop, learning so much just by working with our collaborators, and then seeing this final piece of work at the end. It was very, very satisfying, and hopefully opened some new directions also for other scholars, or the same scholars, to pursue in future studies.
Yes. And this is also a multi-award winning book for listeners who may not know. So it's an endeavor of which I'm sure all of you are very proud. And congratulations. It's an exciting and wonderful project.
Thank you so much.
So you've talked about your efforts to make performance and musicology speak to one another. And in this vein, or perhaps taking this in new directions, I'd love to give you a chance to tell me about the methodological models or tools that you find yourself most often using. How and why did you develop your appreciation for them?
Thank you for asking that question. I try, I guess, to pursue lines of inquiry in whatever directions seem best. So I try not to be wedded too closely to a single methodology, but my work has come to be informed by, let's say, a cluster of lines of interpretation or lines of question asking. So the one that I think has been most fruitful for me in joining musicology and performance started with the Sarah Levy project. I had this little idea, I thought it was going to be a little idea, of trying to just put together a concert with music that she collected or music that she played. And that led to studies of manuscripts that appeared in some odd or curious configurations. So just I think the most obvious example for me is that she played duets with her sisters, duets and sometimes trios with her sisters on multiple keyboard instruments. So I think from the 19th century, many of us are used to seeing four-hand piano music, and they're often arrangements of, you know, symphonies or other large-scale works, even operas. And there's been some wonderful recent work on that. But what they would do would be to take, for example, a trio sonata and arrange it, sometimes reading from part books, but sometimes actually just reading off the score and arranging it at sight for two keyboard instruments, sometimes using a harpsichord and a forte piano together. And so I found a collaborator, my wonderful friend, Yiheng Yang, who's just been game for really anything over the years. And she and I have now been playing together for, it's almost 10 years, hard to believe. And we started playing these harpsichord forte piano duets together. Practice, the act of trying that and kind of seeing how it went, opened up so many questions and puzzles that needed solving in order for us to make the music work. So I think just that kind of practical application where you have to make the music work artistically rather than just kind of studying it from the armchair, as it were, it just prompts you to think through things that you don't otherwise get to think through. So the keyboard duet, the forte piano harpsichord duo, became a little sub area of my research. And I think it overlaps in some ways with Jewish music themes. And in some ways, it's just sort of general performance practice themes. And that was the source of multiple articles and book chapters. So that's kind of one area of inquiry. And Sarah Levy also led me to a totally different project, which was a monograph on musical salons in the second half of the 18th century, because she hosted a musical salon. But she was one of many, many women who did that. And so my second single author book is a study of musical salons in a wide range of locales, from Rome to Vienna to Berlin to London to Paris to Philadelphia to Madrid, and sort of locating these salons and locating these women and reading them, trying to understand what they were doing and their agendas and their self-fashioning and their self-presentation really through a feminist lens, right? Centering their priorities, their interests, their talents as expressed in this social setting of the salon, as opposed to in the public sphere. And so I have to thank Sarah Levy for pointing me in all these different directions. But those are just kind of two examples of the themes and the methodologies that I've tried to use.
Just out of sheer curiosity, can you introduce our listeners to one of the other women that you stumbled across or didn't expect to find from the Salonnière project?
Sure. Well, actually, one of the other women whom I wound up writing quite a bit about was Madame Brion. Her full name was Anne-Louise Boivin d'Ardancourt Brion de Jouy. So nice French aristocratic name. And the reason I got to her at first was that she also played forte, piano, harpsichord duets in her salon in Paris. So using different styles of instruments, because keyboard instruments varied from city to city and from builder to builder. And she was a real advocate for the English square piano, where Sarah Levy would have had central German style pianos. So Madame Brion was the second salonnière whom I came to meet. She was also an amateur composer. She would play these duets and trios with her daughters. She was friendly with Benjamin Franklin during the years when he was living in Paris as ambassador of the newly formed United States. And they exchanged letters and he wrote stories for her and they played chess together. And so she became a really interesting figure to me, not least because just really through the generosity of a friend, I have become the caretaker, the babysitter, I guess, of a beautiful English square piano from 1780. It's an antique instrument that is in beautiful playing condition, and it's almost exactly the sort of instrument that Madame Brion would have owned. So there too, I've been able to use the instrument to learn about her sound world, her aesthetic ideals, to learn more about what her compositions are kind of trying to do. And just as a little aside, so later this spring, there will be a new TV show coming out, a mini series coming out on Apple TV with Michael Douglas as Benjamin Franklin. And one of the characters is Madame Brion. So I got to record some of the music for this Apple TV series on this English square piano. And so that will be out soon. Seen or heard the final cut. So I guess we'll see what happens.
I mean, it's amazing. I hope I get to take a listen to all of this at some point.
Thank you.
Many scholars celebrate the opportunity to teach others as an extension of their research pursuits. Can you tell me a little bit about one of your recent lecturing or teaching experiences and how it has contributed to your research agenda?
I was in Toronto a few weeks ago. I know you're a Toronto native, right?
I am, yes.
So I was in Toronto a few weeks ago at York University. I was giving a concert. It was really a lecture recital at York University, where there's a series organized by Dr. Noam Lemish, who's a wonderful jazz pianist, a series on the theme of Jewish music. So Noam asked me if I had a topic that I could present in this concert series. And I hadn't really intended to be focused on this at the time, but with the invitation, he got me thinking about what topics I could explore. And that brought me to Harriet Abrams. Harriet Abrams was a singer. She started out as a singer in Drury Lane Theatre in London. She was apparently from a Jewish musical family, one of a number of high profile and high skill, very accomplished Jewish musical families in Georgian London in particular. And so Harriet Abrams started out as a singer on the stage, and then she moved into concerts, not in a theatrical setting, but she, for example, sang at the Handel Centennial Commemoration in 1784 in Westminster Abbey. And then she would sing in private concerts and benefit concerts, including with people like Franz Joseph Haydn and Joseph Salomon, who was a big kind of concert organizer and manager in late 18th century London. And then Harriet Abrams turned to composition, and she composed many really interesting sentimental ballads, some of them with a kind of dark or gothic flavor, including some on the theme of immigration and things like The Immigrant or Nanine the Immigrant. And so she's exploring themes of belonging, of wandering, of isolation, of being an outsider. And in addition to that theme of immigration, she has songs about the orphan and songs about the gambler or the felon, people who are kind of on the dark, unknown layer of society, whom, many musical people who had pianos in their homes, for example, would not necessarily associate with. So she's drawing on this poetry, which is kind of proto-Gothic poetry, and intending, I think, to create a sense of sympathy. So even though she, and by sympathy, I mean, I'm using the term in the 18th century way, meaning empathy for other people. And so she never wrote a song about being Jewish or about Jewish identity or Jewish themes. But I think that she's using the genre of the sentimental ballad and really leaning into that genre as a way of identifying with the other in society. Now, this is all complicated by the fact that she and other members of her family converted away from Judaism in 1791. So before she composed many of these ballads, first of all, I don't know how widely known it was that she converted. And second, her name, Abrams, would have clearly signaled a Jewish heritage. So I think, she still would have been kind of negotiating aspects of that Jewish heritage in her compositions. But that sort of complicates the question of, like, is this Jewish music? Is any music written by a Jewish person or someone of Jewish heritage Jewish music? Or does something about the outsider themes, the kind of outsider status that she explores in these songs, is that something that we can point to as being a kind of Jewish trait or something that was sparked by her Jewish heritage? So these are more questions than answers, but this is a whole topic and a whole set of questions that I would not have started asking if not for Noam's very kind invitation to come to Toronto. So that's one example, I suppose.
Awesome. And so is this project where you see yourself heading next intellectually?
Well, I don't know. I'm dancing around the topic in a couple of different ways, including in May of 2024, I'll be working with a wonderful team of musicians to bring a concert to the Bloomington Early Music Festival on the theme of Jewish musicians in 18th century London. And so Harriet Abrams is one of them, but we'll also be exploring, for example, the work of Jacob and James Cerveto, two father and son cellists who sort of advanced the cello in the 18th century and left some really wonderful cello sonatas. So that's another example. And we'll be doing that same program at Rutgers University and at the Center for Jewish History in New York, thanks to the Jewish Music Forum and the American Society for Jewish Music. And that will happen this fall.
Which we're very excited about over at the Jewish Music Forum. So it's just great to hear that this subject is taking you on the road and allowing you to kind of play out your interest in this subject area.
Thank you. Yeah.
How would you say that you understand the field of Jewish music? What issues or challenges with this field of study do you think that scholars today should remain attentive to?
For me, this question is especially poignant and in some ways difficult right now. As someone who studies early music primarily. I'm very conscious of kind of playing into the vogue for celebrating dead Jews, but not really confronting the realities of what it means to be a Jewish person, much less a Jewish musician in today's day and age. And so I'm trying to make up for that in some different ways, which I could tell you about in a moment, but I will say that I think that it's very easy for people to pat themselves on the back for example, giving awards to books on Jewish music in the early modern period. And I don't think that's the primary motivation why people give awards for those things. But I think it's sort of comfortable to say, yes, in history, in studying history, Judaism is part of a diverse cultural landscape and embodies that ideal of diversity. But I think it's much more difficult for people to look at Jews in the world today and say, I'm going to object to anti-Semitism when I see it now. And I think that what I understand to be some serious inversions of truth that are happening in the media, but especially in academia today, inversions of truth that have led to rampant anti-Israel, certainly anti-Israel sentiment, but I think also very clearly anti-Israel sentiment that has spilled over, fully into anti-Semitism. I have some serious discomfort and have had a difficult year because of what I understand to be rampant anti-Semitism in and institutionalized anti-Semitism in academia today. So I'm very conscious of needing to attend to those issues as well. So even as I pursue early music and, think about dead Jews, right? And the way that they made music and the way that they navigated identity and culture, I also want to be thinking about what that looks like today. And so, as you know, I've been doing some writing about academia today, some related to music and some not at all related to music. But I'm also looking for ways of writing about music in Israel post October 7th, 2023, and also musical responses in the US Jewish community to the events of October 7th and the resulting war.
Waiting. תגידי מה בדיוק קרה, מה עינייך ראו, מה אוזנייך שמעו. דברי איתי, תגידי מה בדיוק קרה, מה עינייך ראו, מה אוזנייך שמעו.
Because I think that these questions about culture, about music, help to humanize the story. And I think that humanization is being, it's being neglected, it's being overridden, overrun, as it were, by this rampant anti-Semitism, which casts Israelis and Jews as universally bad, certainly Israelis and Jewish Zionists as universally bad. So these are some very troubling trends, and I guess I feel like we all have to do our part to kind of flesh out the full picture. So I guess I'm going to be occupying myself a little bit with those stories as well.
Yeah, as somebody who writes not nearly as early in history as you do, but who writes earlier than our present moment, these are also questions that are on my mind. And I've also been doing some thinking with and through Dara Horn's work, People Love Dead Jews.
People love their Jews, yeah.
Yeah, so this is poignant and resonant for me as well. Do you believe that there is such a thing as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound? Why or why not? If so, how would you characterize it? If this question seems too essentializing, what questions about the music and sound of Jewish experience would you ask instead?
Yeah. So I don't think that there is an identifiable sound. I think that history shows us that Jews have adopted a wide variety of musical practices and musical sounds over the years that can't be reduced to a single sound, and I wouldn't want to try. So for me, the questions are about how music has figured into Jewish life over centuries and millennia, and how Jewish life has helped to constitute music. So what's that reciprocal relationship? How does music function as an expressive vehicle for all people? And certainly that includes Jews over, again, the centuries and the millennia. So those are the questions that occupy me.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, for speaking with me for the podcast. And I look forward to sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish Podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA, and the University of Pennsylvania's Herbert D. Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies. This episode marks the end of season 2, but keep following the show to receive notifications about summer bonus episodes and the launch of season 3. Bye for now.